The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Phil Buchanan, author of Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer WNYM in New York City.
If you were to read a book about effective philanthropy, you would want it to be authored by someone who has examined, studied, and researched this topic from multiple perspectives for many a year. And that is exactly what my next guest has done. And as a result, has produced a clear and thoughtful approach how you can have greater impact with your own philanthropy. He is Phil Buchanan, the president and founding CEO of the Center for Effective Philanthropy. And his wonderful new book is Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. Good evening, Phil, and welcome back to the show.
Denver, thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the book, tell listeners a little bit about the Center for Effective Philanthropy and what you do.
Sure. We work with donors, and historically it's been larger foundations we've worked with to help them to improve their effectiveness and impact. But in recent years, we've really begun to think about broadening our reach, trying to reach individual donors as well who might not be doing their giving through a foundation. So we do that through a research agenda we carry out, through assessment advisory services, and then we also have programming where we bring donors and foundation leaders together to talk about the unique challenge of effective philanthropy.
You know, so many authors, Phil, that I have on the show tell me that they have an urgency they feel about an issue, how it crystallizes in their mind, and that is what provides them the energy and the impetus to go ahead and write this book. Why did you write this book? And why do you believe it is so important right now?
Yeah, a couple reasons. I mean, one is over 17, almost 18 years, I've seen a lot of great examples of philanthropy that's really making a difference and supporting nonprofits that are doing incredible work. And I think it's an untold story, actually, in some ways, how crucial giving and the nonprofit sector is to what makes this country strong. And I've also witnessed donors make the same mistakes, predictable mistakes. And my hope is that the book helps people avoid some of the common pitfalls by educating them a bit about what is distinctly different about giving. So it's really that motivated me to try to figure out what are the lessons we've learned over all those years and put them together in a way that really speaks to people, tells us stories of donors who got it right, donors who got it wrong, of nonprofit leaders, and so on.
Yeah, let me pick up on what you just said there, and that has to do with the context of philanthropy in American society. Share with us a little bit about that, not only the present day, but historically as well.
Yeah, I mean, historically, giving and, of course, the freedom of association has been a part of this country from the very beginning. The settlers came seeking religious freedoms. There has always been an emphasis on organizing to get things done, citizens doing that. Obviously, in 1917, the tax code, codified an encouragement to give through the charitable deduction. And the level of giving in this country has been the envy of the world. And it is sometimes described as stuck at a couple of percent of GDP. I think another way to look at it is that it has kept pace with GDP growth, and that's a real achievement. And so we have a strong and vibrant civil society. We have a nonprofit sector that includes everything from Harvard to the homeless shelter, and we have arts and culture organizations, We have endowed museums, everything in between. And most of our lives as American citizens have been touched by nonprofits in ways that we know, in ways that we don't know, and everything in between, and probably, more altogether than most of us realize. So I think that it's a really important part of this country. It's also much underappreciated, in my view.
Yeah. And the breadth of the sector really does boggle the mind.
Yeah,
it truly
right.
does. Warren Buffett, among others, has said it's an awful lot harder to give money away,
right.
wisely, of course,
yeah.
than it was to make it in the first place.
Yeah.
Why is it so challenging to do this? And what are some of those common pitfalls that you alluded to a moment ago?
Well, I think one, which Warren Buffett, he didn't fall into this trap, is to think that giving is like investing. And it isn't. And the biggest reason it isn't, there's a whole bunch, but the biggest reason it isn't is because you can't measure performance easily in your giving in the way that you can in your investing. So you can finally compare investments or companies on common measures, even if they're working in very different industries. Not so in the world of giving. So even if you could understand the relationship, the sort of causal connection, which you usually can't, between what you gave to and what happened, it's very challenging to compare performance in one area to another. There's not a common impact unit by which you can gauge the results of your giving to arts and culture versus my giving to climate or the environment. So I think it's been a damaging trend, and you and I have talked about this many times over the years, over the last couple of decades, to want to analogize everything about giving to investing and everything about the nonprofit sector to business. They're really different animals.
Yeah, but the language overlaps a lot. We use those analogies. We use those metaphors all the time. And you really think it does a disservice and clouds the issue as opposed to clarifying it.
I do. Yeah, I do. And I think that, I tell this story in the book of sitting in a second year elective class as an MBA student and a sort of self-styled venture philanthropist was a guest speaker. And she was the sort of one of the poster children of the Harvard Business School social enterprise world. And she came in to tell everyone that the nonprofit sector was broken, that nonprofits were badly run, in need of aggressive investors to hold them to account. And she was there to do just that.
Lucky you.
And she had a whole new approach. And it's like utter malarkey, really. I mean, in fact, and one of the things that I've done in writing the book is spent a lot of time with nonprofit leaders who I think are unsung American heroes whose job is actually vastly more complicated and difficult than it would be if they were CEO or of an equivalent size business. They have to do so much more. And so I just think it's important, if you're going to be a wise giver, to actually understand that, how hard these jobs are. And I can share all kinds of stories about that, and I try to do that in the book, and not to say, it's what we really need is nonprofits to act more like business, whatever that even means. Like, what does that mean? The dry cleaner, Google, Volkswagen? It doesn't even really make sense to say that. I think what people mean is they want organizations to be effective.
Yeah.
But then let's talk about that.
Yeah, I've had probably over a dozen nonprofit leaders who've been on the show who were former CEOs of corporations.
Yep.
And one of them said the job was equally difficult, and every other one said the nonprofit was 10 times more difficult than it was running their company.
Exactly.
Well, one of the places where these great sages from the business world came in and were going to fix our sector was in education.
Yeah.
They were going to apply some business principles to education. That may be the poster child of,
right.
of how that's all gone. Give us an idea of how some of that has worked or, let's say, not worked.
Yeah. I think there's this tendency to assume that there's going to be a quick fix, that, we can disrupt education just as easily as Uber disrupted the the taxi, mm-hmm. you know, industry if we just create the right app, you know. So you look at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has done much good work on global health in particular. But you look at the work in education, and it's been characterized by this, I think, hope, really a fantasy, that they will find the one thing. So first it was small high schools. Let's break large high schools into small high schools. We'll get better results. Doesn't seem to be working, although actually some argue that it was, and they moved away too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the truth is, they moved away and they said, okay, next thing is teachers. It's all about effective teachers. We're going to focus on that. It's going to be about teacher evaluation, you know, perhaps linking teacher pay to performance was certainly something a number of education funders were interested in. Okay, nope, that wasn't it. Okay, it's about Common Core.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
a lot of eureka moments, eh?
Yeah, and time and time again, because these problems defy, in general, there are exceptions, but defy sort of single solutions, magic bullets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're interdependent, and cause and effect is hard to predict here, and so it's really challenging. And education, as you say, Denver, is probably the area in which we've seen the most repeated and spectacular failures on the part of donors and big donors. In particular.
Yeah, and of course we have it right here in this area with Mark Zuckerberg and the city of Newark and that $100 million investment. And I think it's somewhat healthy to see that both in his case and in Gates' case, they admitted that these things did not work out and that they were pretty much failures, and that at least is a healthy sign.
Agreed. And I think the lesson from Newark is, and I think this applies to some of the other education efforts as well, is in part that you cannot impose solutions top down. That, as a colleague of mine has said, you know, nobody wants to be told that someone else is the expert on their life,
mm-hmm.
right? So everybody agreed in Newark that the schools were broken and that they needed to be fixed. But the folks in neighborhoods, the families, the kids, the parents who would be affected by the changes were not engaged sufficiently, and yet they have the real expertise and knowledge. So I think one of the really good trends of recent years is we are seeing, I think, a bit more heightened awareness of the need to engage folks on the front lines, the folks whose lives you're trying to improve, in the conversation about what strategies will be most effective.
Yeah, invariably, the people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution.
Exactly.
And that's always been the case. Let me talk about something which is a bane of, I think, each of our existence, and that has to do with the overhead question.
Yeah.
And that narrative still prevails, that when I make a contribution, I am going to be totally focused on how much of that is going to program and how much of that is going to administration and fundraising. And that is going to be a key, if not the key determinant, as to whether I'm going to support an organization. What is wrong with that question, and why does that narrative still carry the day in so many different places?
Well, I think the narrative, to answer the last part first, carries the day because of what I already alluded to, which is the desire for the analog to ROI or profit. So what is the standardized, quantifiable, comparative metric that cuts across program areas? Well, overhead is one.
And it's simple.
And it's simple, except that it's not, because
of course,
the definitions are all over the map.
You can make up any calculation you want to get to your overhead.
Agree. Exactly. And I think, look, I think there are obviously like extreme cases where you have folks you know, spending tremendous amounts on for-profit fundraisers. And, you know, these are abuses, really, which nonprofits have been set up there that are little more than shells for for-profit fundraisers who and you have a very high percentage that's just going in their pockets. Obviously, that shouldn't happen. We need to call it out. But in a ethically run, you know, well-functioning nonprofit organization, their key question is, what are they achieving relative to their goals and relative to their overall budget? And then I think we need to have some faith in folks to allocate that budget as they see fit. And things that sometimes get deemed overhead are in fact necessary to delivering the results. Right. so you look at an organization, you know, feeding the hungry, and you say, well, we only want to pay for the food, mm-hmm. not the rent on the space where the volunteers come and provide the food. You know, that doesn't make any sense.
I think
because the performance measurement challenge is so significant and people find it frustrating and they want something, they gravitate toward what's available. And as a result, they don't always make the best decisions.
Yeah, I had a very interesting guest on the show a while back by the name of Carolyn Fine. She's
yeah.
from the UK.
Yeah, she's terrific.
Yeah, she really is, and a very funny woman. And she leads an organization called Giving Evidence.
Yeah.
And she's a physicist who came over to this sector. And what she did is she went to the Give Well blog where they rate the best organizations. And in through her analysis, she found that those that they rated most highly had the highest overhead.
Right.
So
right.
it just goes to show you that it can be totally misleading. So if we're not going to do that, how does a donor then begin to analyze the performance and measure the impact of that organization so they can make an intelligent decision on their own contribution?
Yeah. Well, and here's where it's more work than anybody wants it to be. But but really what I think you want to look for is answers to three pretty simple questions. What are they doing? In other words, like, what are their goals?
Mm-hmm.
How are they doing it? Like, what is their approach or their strategies? And then what information do they have about how it's going? So what are the metrics that they use to gauge their success? So to give an example, an organization that I write about in the book that I also, you know, after learning about them, have started personally, you know, supporting, is called UTEC. And they're in Lowell, Lawrence, and Haverhill in outside Boston. And they focus on working with the very the most violent young people who are involved in gang life.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to recruit them out of gang life, get them employed at one of their social enterprises, help them turn their lives around. And, you know, talk about a tough job, right? And, you know, so what do they monitor? They monitor recidivism. You know, what percentage of their young people who they work with end up falling back into a life of crime? They compare that to state averages and they see how they're doing. So that's how they know. And that's what you want to look at. What are they doing? How are they doing it? How do they know if they're making progress?
You know, I've been in this sector my entire life, and there always seems to be a flavor of the month.
Yes.
Around discussions of the sector. And currently, it would be the evils of big philanthropy.
Yeah.
And how it is undermining democracy.
Yeah.
And perhaps the leading voice there would be Anand Girihardos, who has written a book which has captured a lot of attention called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of...
What was it? Changing the World.
Yeah. The author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. And he believes that big donors are merely perpetuating a system that led to their extraordinary wealth in the first place. You tend to look at these matters in a very balanced way. Give us your critique on that.
Okay. I'll try to live up to that and say I agree with Anand that there is, you know, that there are, I should say, examples of donors who have used their philanthropy to distract, for example, from their unethical business practices.
Like the Sacklers.
Exactly. And Anand speaks all the time about mm-hmm. that example. And I also think that there has been too much of a kind of happy talk in which it's actually business that's going to solve all our problems, right? Without recognizing that, you know, if business could solve all our problems, they'd probably be solved, right? That there are some challenges that markets and government haven't been able to work out, and that's often where philanthropy comes in. So those are areas in which I agree.
Okay.
But I think Anand paints with a absurdly broad brush, that it is a overly generalized caricature that denies much of the good that givers do, including ultra-wealthy givers who are motivated by a genuine and real desire to have a positive impact on the world, not to preserve the status quo mm-hmm. or to buttress their own reputation. So I think it's unfortunate and unfair to paint with that broad a brush. And I worry about it from the standpoint both of what signals it sends about what we want to encourage. I mean, it's interesting to note that recently, in not too distant times, there was a lot of critique of many of the very wealthiest for not giving enough.
Yeah.
Right?
Buying
and then come in the giving
Buying
pledge
houses.
And so on.
Yeah.
And now we're criticizing them for giving too much.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So and most of the donors, and granted, it's not a representative sample, but the individual donors who we work with, right, they're trying really hard to get it right. And they don't always get it right. And we should call them out when they don't. We shouldn't bow down to anyone. But giving is good, and we should be encouraging it. And I think Anand, and to a certain extent Rob Reich at Stanford
right.
in his book, are conflating a critique of our current approach to taxation,
mm-hmm.
and the belief that the wealthy should be taxed at a higher rate, that, for example, the capital gains should not be taxed at a lower rate than income. A lot of things that I generally agree with. And they're sort of lumping that together with a critique of philanthropy. And ultimately, it's our elected representatives in Congress that have to address the first challenge. Meantime, we have folks who have resources and they have choices about what to do with those resources. And I would like them to try to give back, and I would like to help them to try to do it effectively.
See, that was very balanced.
I try.
On the other hand, I think the number of Americans contributing to charity has been declining
right.
for a number of years. Now, some
right.
of that may have been the recent tax law, but it's been going on longer than that. What
yep.
do you make of that, and are you concerned about that trend?
Concerned? I don't think we actually know the effect of the recent tax law change yet. But I think the data, good reliable data is hard to find on
mm-hmm.
this, but there is data that suggests that there's been a decline in the percentage of households giving. And there's some data that suggests, that middle class families in particular may be giving at lower rates. I think that's hugely concerning. And I think, one of the things, not to bring it back to the book, but that I'm trying to do in the book is inspire people to give by reminding them of the tremendous progress that giving has helped contribute to. So I think some of the decline may be just related to stagnating wages, for many in the middle class. But I wonder if some of it is also related to the fact that we have not sufficiently held up nonprofits, what they can do, what they have done, and that we've had this narrative over the last couple of decades in which we have this sort of business knows best crew saying, hey, philanthropy folks and nonprofit folks, You got it all wrong. Business has all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got Anand and others saying, no, you've got it all wrong. Government's got all the answers. Well, my view is actually no sector's got all the answers. That each of the three sectors has a distinct role to play, that they each need each other to be their best, that none are their best today,
mm-hmm.
And that that's a better lens for how we think about what will make this country be what we want it to be.
Yeah, and I think also a better lens for all this would be if the media every once in a while reported a good story.
Absolutely.
Because so much we hear about the nonprofit sector is the latest scandal.
Absolutely.
That's what's going to make the news.
Right.
Not the things that are really positive. And to the extent that they do it, they're usually puppy dog stories that make
right.
you feel good. But they're
right.
not transformative change stories,
right.
which they should be reporting. Well, you do talk in the book about philanthropy that is done right. So let's talk a little bit about that. And a good example would be the Wilberforce Foundation
yeah.
and the donor behind that. So tell us that story.
Oh, sure. So Rose Letwin was at a Microsoft early employee. She cared a lot, I think as a young girl and certainly as an adult about animals and about the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And she, I think, and this is true of so many donors, she never expected, I don't think, to have the resources that she had and then asked herself, well, what am I going to do? And really has focused on protection of habitats for wildlife and conservation in the Pacific Northwest, in the U.S. and Canada. And they've been hugely successful in helping to preserve land and the natural beauty in that part of the country. And they have done that by supporting usually small and locally based organizations that are fighting to protect whether it be forests or whatever, and by strengthening those organizations, linking them up in a network and providing them the support they need to do their work as best they can. So they're a great example to me, I think, of an organization that is very focused on what they're focused on. They know what they're trying to do, and then they also are very clear about the fact that it is the nonprofits, it is the grantees who are at the center, who are really doing the work, and that their job is to have a relationship with those organizations that strengthens those organizations to do their work better. And I think they've done a really good job.
You spend a lot of time on relationships, don't you?
Yes.
To speak a little bit about that, because they are so important in terms of doing things successfully. What's your thinking on that?
Well, I mean, I think here again, we see the business analogies aren't helpful. So people sometimes say, well, like big donors or foundations will say, our grantees are like customers. Mm. Well, no, they're nothing like customers because the money's flowing in the opposite direction and the power dynamics are completely different. If you and I go out to lunch, you know, someday and we don't like our meal and the service is terrible, we can never go back there again if we want to. We can trash the place online. No fear. You know, if we have a bad If we're running a nonprofit, though, and we have a bad interaction with a big donor, you know, we're not going to say much to anyone about it. And so the dynamics are completely different. And why does that matter? It matters because donors can't do their work effectively if they don't understand what's going on the ground. And the only way they're going to understand what's going on the ground is strong, trusting relationships with their grantees. That's how they're going to hear, actually, the strategy we're trying isn't working, rather than, oh, yes, it's working wonderfully. Because you know, just to underline the point, folks are predisposed to tell big donors what they think those donors want to hear.
Yeah.
And so that lack of good, candid data and information can get in the way of refinements in strategy that need to occur. And we see this time and time again. So I just think relationships are absolutely crucial to being an effective donor.
Yeah, and it also gets back to this overhead issue because I know so many who will tell the foundation an overhead, which the foundation knows is not the real overhead.
Right.
But they're trying to get the grant.
So
it's a dance. It's a dishonest discussion.
Right.
And if it starts that way, it stays that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like the sector, maybe this should be your next book. We need a whole new taxonomy to really describe these things because we're relying on so many. Even the word nonprofit in itself is describing what we're not.
Right.
So perhaps language will be critical and perhaps increasing that understanding. One of your major objectives at the Center for Effective Philanthropy, CEP, in 2019 is to nurture and create a culture of innovation and creativity. And that is so difficult to do when you're turning out the kind of work that you're turning out day in and day out. How are you going about trying to achieve that, Phil?
Yeah, we definitely don't have that one figured out. Mm-hmm. I'd be the first to tell you. I think, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, I was the first staff member, basically, of CEP. Mm-hmm. And in the early days, we had all kinds of time to think about what we might do because we weren't doing anything, you know, and nobody knew we existed, right? And we knew we had to innovate and come up with some things that people were interested in.
The good old days.
Yeah. Once that happens, then you've got to satisfy the demand, and so it's tricky. So I think there's a couple of things. One is just to set aside time. So literally we're going to have
simple as that sounds.
Yeah, a week this summer where nobody works on anything other than new stuff. And they're going to be able to work on basically whatever they want and pitch their colleagues to work on it with them. I think another thing is breaking patterns in a variety of ways of how conversations happen, who leads them in an organization, you know, tends to default to the most tenured or senior person in the room. That doesn't make any sense. You know, a lot of interesting things happen when you just ask somebody else to lead the meeting. There's a bunch of – just a constant emphasis also on experimentation and learning. Go ahead and try that in a way where the consequences of failure are not too high, right? And then let's see what happens. And really encouraging that. I think organizations in all kinds of unintended ways sometimes penalize people for taking risks. And obviously, there's certain risks you don't want people to take.
Sure.
But there are areas in which you can encourage risk and there isn't a lot of downside. And to identify what those areas are and then encourage people to go take chances and try things, I think is something we're trying to do more of.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, people talk about embracing failure, but yep. all the organizations that I've ever been to that embrace failure seem to be the ones with the highest standards. And they're very rigorous.
Right.
And it's the other side of it, which people never talk about. They think it's, oh, we can fail.
Right.
Those organizations avoid failure as much as they possibly can. Let me close with this, Phil. In the process of writing this book, was there something that perhaps you had always sort of thought about in the back of your mind, but never really fully appreciated in terms of its centrality and importance to the whole philanthropic sector?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that I did in writing the book is try to get beyond all of the research we've done on nonprofits and their perspectives on donors and what would be helpful to them through all the survey work that we do, all of the qualitative comments that we read, and actually go out and spend time, you know, to spend a day or a half day in different organizations. And this is something I'm continuing to do, is to be inspired by the sort of heroism of the staff and volunteers in community-based organizations working on the front lines of the toughest challenges. So we're, you know, spent time at a community-based health organization in Houston, Texas, met the executive director and saw what they're doing to try to help the most desperately poor there. Spent time with a volunteer, a retired lawyer who just turned 80, you know, who comes in and gives coordinates the vision testing that they have outside folks come in and do for poor people who might not otherwise have access to it. The sense of community among and sort of passion for the mission among the staff and the volunteers, and the degree to which that purpose is motivating them. And I feel like in our society, we read a lot about you know, corporate CEOs and business titans and the Kardashians and whoever else. And I would love to see us reading about folks like this, you know, the staff and the volunteers who are doing this tremendously important work that nobody else is doing and that communities so desperately need.
Well, if it's going to lift the psyche and make this country feel more positive, those stories do definitely need to be told. Well, Phil Buchanan, the president and founding CEO of the Center for Effective Philanthropy, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. The book is Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. It truly provides the grounding and clarity that every donor needs to have, and you should definitely pick it up. Thanks so much, Phil, for being on the show.
Denver, thank you so much for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.